This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Hello, Mike, we're rolling.
Hello, 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 and welcome to Ages and Icons.
That's terrible.
It
I'm Mike Crisologo.
And I'm Gina Bucci. Hello.
That was horrible.
Well, today's, you know what, but it was just in the spirit of today's Cockney guest, Michael Caine.
Yeah, Michael Caine. I'm a huge, huge Michael Caine fan.
Mm-hmm.
And when you are interviewing him, especially if it's only, like for us, we were speaking to him on the phone. If you only hear his voice, you picture in your head all of your favorite Michael Caine characters. He's got one of those most distinct voices. I first got to know him as a kid, or not as a kid, but in my, I guess it was teenage years, with the Cider House Rules. Mm-hmm. That was when I first really became aware of him, and he won the Oscar for that as well.
What an incredible feat. Well, it's his second Oscar. His first is Hannah and Her Sisters, right?
Yes.
What an incredible feat to not only win the Oscar for Cider House Rules, but I mean, he's playing a doctor from Boston, yeah. Right? From Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And he kept his accent.
Yeah, he's still Michael Caine. And he won the Oscar.
And nobody cared, because nobody cares.
Yeah, because he's Michael Caine.
Because his authenticity in that role superseded the fact that he kept his Cockney accent.
He's so good. And when I was talking to him on the phone, that's all I could see in my head was that character.
Yeah.
Everybody knows his voice. He's one of those actors that you just instantly recognize it.
Yeah.
But how about you? What's your favorite Michael Caine performance?
I came to Michael Caine from Dirty Rotten Scoundrels because
nice.
I was a big Steve Martin fan and I loved that movie. And then I was that I did not know Michael Caine before that. And I loved him in that movie so much that then I saw Jaws for the Revenge in theaters.
Yes, I remember seeing that as a kid. I remember seeing that as a kid going, why the hell is Michael Caine in this movie?
And I remember seeing that as a kid and being like, oh my God, he's after them. It's the revenge. I was so into it. Turns out it's a horrible movie.
It's terrible.
I love good, bad movies. That's exactly what it is. If you want to be offended by an accent, Mira Van Peebles is your guy in that movie. Michael Caine has got
he's in that.
Yeah, he is. Michael Caine's got one of my favorite quotes about Jaws for the Revenge. He says, I actually wrote it down because I didn't want to misquote it. I have never seen it, but by all accounts, it's terrible. However, I've seen the house that it built, and it's terrific. Well said. That makes me respect him even more. He's 85.
He's 85 years old, still working.
Still like a huge name.
But it's funny, and I say still working, because he did an interview when he was nearing 45 and said that he was going to retire then.
Yeah.
At 45, he's like, 45. I think I'm a little old for it at that point. God, that was like the worst British accent that
no,
was ever
fine.
Done.
No, it's fine.
But, I mean, you look at his, we were talking about this earlier, but at his resume in Alfie, The Italian Job, Sleuth, Battle of Britain.
All these movies have been remade.
Yeah,
well, not
I know,
Battle
right?
of Britain. But Sleuth, he was in the original Sleuth in, I think it was like 72 or something, early 70s, I think, with Laurence Olivier. Then they remade it in the mid-2000s with Jude Law in the Michael Caine role, and Michael Caine took over the Laurence Olivier role.
The Man Who Would Be King, A Bridge Too Far, Educating Rita.
Great movie, yeah. Educating Rita, everybody.
Yep.
Julie right. Walters is fantastic.
You know what, actually, when you asked me my favorite Michael Caine movie, that's got to be up there, too. I forgot about that one. But I remember seeing that
there.
When I was younger, too. Hannah and Her Sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes on and on. We talked about Cider House Rules and such.
Can't forget the Batman movies, Dark Knight.
Yeah, he was Alfred.
Mm-hmm. I think a great choice by Michael Caine to take on that role because it introduced him to a whole new audience, a younger audience that came to him. They got to come to you from somewhere, right?
Of course. And he is perfect for that fatherly sort of instinct and relationship that Alfred is supposed to have with Bruce Wayne.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It was funny because his latest film is actually a documentary, the one that Michael Caine and I spoke about.
My Generation.
My Generation. So it's a documentary about the 60s, about the 1960s. The documentary focuses mostly on the 60s in Britain, but it does I think, echo a lot of what we talk about here at Zoomer for the experience of the boomer generation in Canada and in America as well. There's a lot of crossover across the pond, obviously. And it's a really, really great little nostalgic look. It's sort of part autobiographical, sort of Michael Caine explaining where he is during all of these sort of pivotal events through the 60s and where his career stands, but then also pulling back and looking at the generation as a whole. And it's a really cool little nostalgic look at the generation.
Okay, well, let's get to your interview. But Michael Caine kind of threw us for a loop on this one.
Yeah, he was calling from London, I believe, and we were told to expect the call at a certain time. So, I went to have lunch so that I would be on a full stomach for the call. And I guess there was some miscommunication in the timing or the time change or what have you. And I was sitting there with a mouthful of, I don't even remember what I was eating, a sandwich or something. I think it was a sandwich, actually. And my phone rings.
This is relevant.
Yeah. I see this long-distance call come in on my cell phone. And I was going, uh-oh, this might not be good. And I answered the phone, with a full mouthful, hello, Mike speaking. And like, hello, Mike. I'm calling for Michael Caine. And it's like, oh, my God. I was in the cafeteria here at Zoomer. I had to grab all my stuff. And everybody's, throwing their chairs out of the way so I can plow through and get to my desk to hit the recorder.
Then Mike comes to me. Michael Caine's calling me. I'm at my desk editing something.
Yeah, because we were supposed to be in the studio.
Right. And I was like, oh, my God, no. Like, I can't get into the studio. It's locked. We couldn't even get in.
Yeah.
So long story short, the audio quality is a little bit poorer than usual lately because we just had to record the call.
Yeah, I was recording it, through the phone at my desk with my own recorder.
So apologies for that, but I still think it's okay. So
And Michael Caine's just as delightful.
He's just as delightful. So here's Mike's interview with Michael Caine.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm good, Michael. You all right?
I'm very good. Thanks so much for your time today.
That's okay.
Well, first I wanted to tell you that I saw the documentary and I really enjoyed it, so congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad you did. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
I guess my first question sort of off the top was, what made you want to sort of participate in this documentary in the first place?
Well, I'm great friends with Simon Fuller. And we were always going to dinner and we're talking, and occasionally we talk about the 60s. And, he's a professional producer. I'm a co-producer on it. But and one day, we were talking about the 60s again, and he said, why don't we put this on a movie? Why don't we do a documentary about it, There's lots of material, and we've got you to do commentary, and everything. And so it came about like that. And I was very interested in doing it because it was one of the most important, not only one of the most important periods in my life, but one of the most important periods for people of working class in England ever.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you mentioned at the beginning of the documentary how you, when you were a child, you and your friends would ask your parents, well, what was so good about the good old days? So for yourself, when you're looking back on the 60s, I would ask the same question, in your mind, what was so good about those days?
Freedom. Freedom to do the things we wanted to do and how it changed everything for everybody. The society was very deeply etched into everything. I mean, if you were working class, there are things you couldn't do. You just couldn't do them. It didn't matter what you thought or how clever you were, you couldn't do them. And the 60s, I always saw the 60s as the sort of, my generation, to quote the title, my generation, I was born in one of the biggest slumps ever, economic slumps in the 30s. I grew up in World War II, and then I was sent to Germany and Korea to fight for my country when I was 20. And then when I got home, it was miserable and smoggy London, and there was rationing, and it was the 50s. The war was over, but not at home, only with soldiers. And then we got to the 60s, and Khrushchev banged on a table and said, we have the atom bomb, you have 4 minutes to live. And basically, although no one ever said it, through our minds, that idea went. We got 4 minutes to live. We've had nothing but trouble, poverty, war, bombing, blitz, killing. Why the hell don't we have a good time? And for 4 minutes, we'll have a good time. And we did. That's what started it. And it was nothing that anybody said to each other. Nobody led it. It was just individual people just saying, sod this, I'm fed up with this. I'm not going to take this anymore. And we just said, right, we're going to do our own thing and have a good time.
And you were 33 around that time. You mentioned in the documentary that you felt more like a, sort of a grandfather within that generation. And so,
Yeah. I was the 33 in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, and 1966. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I was sort of 27, 28 when the 60s started. Yeah, but they actually started in the 50s. I mean, John Osborne wrote "Look Back in Anger" in the 50s. It went on with someone who was never including among the sort of 60s generation. Was Richard Burton,
right,
who was the son of a working class coal miner, and became a great actor, you know, but he was never included in the 60s because he became a great Shakespearean actor. Instead of sort of going into working class roles, he did great Hamlets and everything.
Right, and I mean, looking back on it now, did you gain any sort of new insight into those times or into your own generation that maybe you hadn't realized before you started working on this documentary?
I realized how for so many hundreds of years my country had been stuck in this barrier, these barriers, you know. I'm the son of a Cockney cleaning lady, you know, and you know the way they're treated, and I just couldn't believe it. And the greatest thing for us in the 60s was for actors, was the writers came first, and they started to write about working class people.
Right.
You know, I mean, I understudied Peter O'Toole in The Long and the Short and the Tall, which was the first British play, stage play, about private soldiers ever. It was all about officers. We never went to see British war movies. We went to see American war movies, From Here to Eternity, and Naked and the Dead. They were about private soldiers. All British war movies were about officers. There were no British war movies about private soldiers, you know?
Yeah.
And so we've been stuck in that, but we were a generation that said we're not going to take it anymore. We didn't.
So I guess it's kind of fortunate for you to have been in your profession at that time. Had you been trying to do that 20 years earlier, it wouldn't have worked, right?
A person for the timing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which had nothing to do with me. I mean, the writers came before me. Bill Norton wrote Alfie long before he'd heard about me.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when you talk about the end of the 60s in the movie, we talk about how your generation affected change, and now change was beginning to affect your generation. And
yeah,
now when we look at your generation, as they're in their 60s, they're in their 70s, they're in their 80s.
I'm 85.
Right. And so... Yeah. I mean, that spirit, though, of the time period is still within a lot of those people in that generation. And, I mean, I guess my question is, do you see that spirit within them as they sort of reinvent how we think about aging today, just like how they reinvented the world back when...
Oh, my God, they've all gone so much further.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just look at what the communications they had, computers and everything. And everybody has a telephone, everybody has a computer in their hands.
Yeah.
They even have a torch so that they can read the paper.
Yeah.
You know, it's this generation has not blossomed yet, you know?
Yeah.
But when it does, it will be quite extraordinary, I think, because their knowledge is unbelievable.
Yeah, and
I mean, I have an iPad and I'm forever looking at it, at stuff I want to know, you know?
Yeah.
Even in conversations with my wife, as we'll say something, you know, and you just go, you say, what date was the Charles Boyer born, you know? And you look it up, it's there.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I mean. It seems like maybe previous generations, if you were 50 years old or 60 or 70, 70 or 80, you were expected to be a certain way. But now with your generation, it's the first one that says, well, it doesn't matter if you're 50 or 60 or 70 or 80, you can do whatever you want. And that seems sort of unique to your generation.
Well, the working class did working class jobs, which are dull and boring. And part of the psychology of it was that you couldn't wait to retire and live on the pension and not go to work, not get up at 6:30 in the morning, you know?
Yeah.
And to live a life where you couldn't wait to retire is unbelievable. We lived a life where we couldn't wait to get up in the morning.
Right. And so, I mean, obviously, I know there was an interview with you back when you were 40, or before in your 40s, I think, or before you were in your 40s, and you mentioned that you'd like to retire by the time you were 45. And of course, that's come and gone, and you're still
working. Yeah, I'm 85. I'm still working. You know?
And so, what fuels that passion for you to keep going and keep working?
Well, you have to remember, I'm doing something that I love.
Yeah.
I was an amateur actor. I'm being paid very well to do something that I did for nothing. I don't tell people I did it for nothing, except they want me to do it again. But I don't do it for nothing now. But I do something that I love. And when I started it, I didn't set out to become. Sometimes I see interviews with young people these days, and the reporter will say to them, well, what do you want to do in life? They say, well, I want to be rich and famous. They don't mention what they're going to do to be rich and famous, you know? I was the exact opposite of that. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to be an actor. And I absolutely knew and positively sure that I would never be rich or famous. I had a Cockney accent. I wasn't very good looking. I wasn't a movie star, obviously. And I was living in this society where the theater wouldn't, you know, it was way above my social grade. And so I became an actor in repertory in the country for nothing. Well, £3 a week. And knowing that I would never be rich and famous, the only thing I did was, I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to be the best actor that I can be. Nothing to do with anyone else. There'll always be actors better than me and worse than me. I'm just going to be the best actor I can be. And that was my standard up to this day of my life.
Well, and there's maybe this is sort of connected to that, because you have a great quote in the film that says, youth is not a time of life, it's a state of mind, and which it seems like it's sort of connected to that idea of still going with your passions. And I was wondering, just for our readers, many of whom are in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and so on, what advice you might give for just sort of keeping that mentality or in that state of mind where youth is in your brain, not you know, on your body necessarily.
Oh, yeah, well, that's the point. For a start, as an actor talking physically, you get to a stage where you're so old you don't get the girl anymore, so you can't be a movie star.
Yeah.
Because a movie star always gets a girl at the end of the movie, right?
Yeah.
But then you go on and you become, like me, a character actor because I wanted to do it. And I think the trick is to find another area of what you do that you can do when you get old. If you're a mad dancer, when you get old, you can take up the waltz. You know what I'm saying? And you still be the best person in the world at the waltz.
Absolutely. And just before we go, I wanted to ask you about the film, about My Generation. It's going to be watched, obviously, by people in your generation, but it's also going to be watched by people who aren't in your generation, maybe who are younger and sort of learning about.
Oh, yeah. I hope so.
Of course, yes. What do you, for those people who are younger, who don't know a lot about that generation, what do you hope they take from this film?
I hope that they take from the film that no matter what anybody says to them, they don't have to stay where they are. The world is open for you. And don't believe anybody who tells you it isn't.
That's a great message. I think that's probably a great message, whether you're 15 or 85 or 105,
yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Kane, I know we're just about out of time, so I just wanted to thank you again for your time today, and congratulations again on the film.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
good interview, man.
It worked out, considering it was had a mouthful of sandwich and had you to did. Rush to the desk find my interview questions.
You know, Mike, don't forget to chew.
Yeah, you know, there was a time I had an interview scheduled with Andrea Martin, and she was in the bath when she remembered she had to call me. So when I picked up the phone, she's huffing and puffing. She goes, "I just ran out of the bathtub. I'm soaking wet, but I remembered we had an interview, so I had to call you." So sometimes these things happen, and they make for good stories.
She should have stayed in the bath. It would have been a very relaxing interview.
Absolutely.
Especially if we were doing a pod. Hope you're listening, Andrea Martin. Call us from the bath. I would love to do. Oh, I'll take a bath, too, at the same time. Why not?
Yeah, Michael Caine, he's got so much history in this business, and so it was interesting to talk to him about something that wasn't necessarily Hollywood, but talking about his own life growing up in that generation, because that's what Zoomer's about, right? Zoomer, it's boomers with zip. It's about that generation that grew up at that time, and he mentions in the documentary that he was 33 at the beginning of the 60s, so he felt like the grandfather of the generation.
Yeah.
So he was a little bit older and had maybe a little bit more, I don't know if you want to say nuanced or mature perspective on stuff that was going on compared to somebody who was like 18 and just running wild.
They have some great footage of him at that age in the
60s. Oh, God, yeah, yeah.
He looks so dashing. Oh, he looks great. I could see why Mike Myers be kind of based Austin Powers based off of him as Alfie. But Michael Caine in general. And it was just such a great idea to put him as his dad in those movies.
Yeah.
But Michael Caine, when I thought of 60s, like especially British 60s, always Michael Caine comes to mind.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, that's why he feels so at home in those Austin Powers movies. Like, this is where he belongs.
And exactly.
There's a great scene in the documentary where he goes back to his childhood street and he goes up to his neighbor's house and the woman who lives there now is probably in her 60s or 70s, you know, but she remembers him when he was a kid.
Oh, wow.
And she has this little conversation with him and it's very cute, you know, because now he's a famous actor and he goes back and he's so polite and everything to her. But he has a really interesting take. Like, he talks about how the 60s are, it was about he says here, freedom to do things you want to do and how it changed everything for everybody. And you really get that from the documentary.
Yeah, I liked how he talked about how he feels that this generation, the current millennial generation and even the one coming up after it, the younger kids, how he feels that they have such a sense of wanting to change things as they are now. And he thinks that it really mirrors the 60s generation.
Yeah.
Because that was the same fight that they were having. Like their perspective in this doc is that why should we accept what is happening? Like, they were the first generation to not accept the status quo.
Right.
And to change it.
Right.
Yeah, interesting.
No, and you see it everywhere today. And I mean, every generation pushes back. To quote Paul Simon, every generation throws a hero up the pop charts. Every generation wants to break free of their parents' way. But like this generation with social media, and you see it especially in politics in the United States. Where
it's
there's
the
like,
social change
that
they're pushing for. Not just for me.
No, not just for us. Yeah, for social change. And they're right. Taking to social media, and it's like teenagers and students in schools where there's shootings and stuff, and they're going on social media and they're outdoing the establishment because they know they grew up with that. They were born into it, whereas the establishment isn't as familiar with it. So I think there's a lot of comparisons. I mean, you talk about the 60s and now, and this is also the comparisons with Trump and Nixon. So, yeah, they keep going deep and deep. But it's interesting to look back on that generation through the eyes of someone who was so prominent within that generation. And he had a great quote in there, and I'm just paraphrasing here. He mentioned how in the 60s, his generation pushed for change, and by the end of the 60s, change was pushing them. Mm-hmm. I mean, as we all know, they had the Summer of Love, and then the 70s came, and everything really changed at the end of the 60s. But you look at it now, and I was really interesting because that same generation, you talk about time changing them. Now they're entering that sort of third act of life. They're in their 60s and 70s, and Michael Caine's in 85. And I really loved his quote because I asked him about retiring, you know, because now that generation, as we talk about here all the time, is redefining age and how we age, just like how they redefined youth and music and culture and counterculture in the 60s. And he had that great quote about how, you know, back then for the working class, the psychology was that you couldn't wait to retire and live on a pension and not go to work and get up at, you know, 6:30 in the morning. And he says, and to live a life where you couldn't wait to retire is unbelievable. We lived a life where we couldn't wait to get up in the morning. Mm-hmm. And you look at someone like Michael Caine and so many others of that generation who are in their, like he's 85, there's a lot of people in their 60s and 70s and 80s and so on that don't want to retire. Or they retire from one job and then start a second career, a second act.
Right.
And it I think it's just part of that generation's DNA.
Yeah, just keep interested.
Yeah.
This is in the documentary, right? My generation.
Yes.
Youth is not a time of life. It's a state of mind.
Yes.
And that's totally sums up Michael Caine to me.
It does. Yeah, because he's still going, right?
Yeah.
And that is a great that's a great sort of thing to remember at any time in life, right? Like you don't have to be 85 to sort of consider that. And he said that at the end of the interview. He said, I hope that they take from this film that no matter what anybody says to them, they don't have to stay where they are. The world is open for you and don't believe anybody that tells you it isn't. And that's great advice whether you're 16 and watching this or whether you're 66 or whether you're 96, you know. The world is open to you. I also find it interesting when he talked about being a character actor and how that helped him, his career continue. Because I remember we interviewed Christopher Plummer a number of years back, and he has, like, he would talk about how he, like, everybody wanted him to be the leading man because he's so good looking, but he always wanted to be a character actor. And
right.
So now at this age, Christopher Plummer in his 80s as well finally gets to be a character actor. And, you know, Michael Caine is saying the same thing. And I spoke with Susan Sarandon at TIFF too, actually, this year. And Susan Sarandon said the same thing, that, like, if she had built her career on being the most beautiful woman in the movie every time, mm-hmm. maybe her career wouldn't still be going at 72.
Right.
So it's an interesting sort of theme that I find when we talk to a lot of these performers in their 70s and older, that being a character actor allows them to perform more than if they were just relying on their handsome or beautiful looks.
It also allows you to play more interesting characters.
Oh, of course.
Right?
Of course. You coined this at one of our first podcasts. You called it Name Drop Lane.
Yeah.
That I sometimes wander down. But Martin Landau said that too.
Oh, sometimes?
Yeah, sometimes. The occasional time I mentioned somebody
driving
else
down
introduced.
It today. Okay, go on. Beep, beep. Mike's coming down. Name Drop Lane. Get out of the way.
We're stopping and taking pictures as we go. But yeah, no, Martin Landau said that once in an interview before he passed away. When I was talking to him, he said, that he refused to play those grumpy old man characters.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I'm in my 90s. Why am I playing some grumpy old grandpa? Like, that's such a cliche. I want interesting, compelling characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, isn't there, there's a message in that, and Michael Caine and Susan Sarandon and all the, in life, like, why, even as you age, there's no reason to settle for the status quo, right? Like, whether you're an actor looking for a part or whether you're anybody in life, going out there and just trying to live your life day to day. There's no reason to settle for the status quo if you want something more interesting, more exciting.
Just go for it. Make it.
Yeah, and in the 60s, that's what this generation did. And, you know, why stop when they make it into their own 60s mm-hmm. and beyond, right?
So you can find our podcast on everythingzoomer.com. It's Ages and Icons. And we're also available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Okay, so the film is My Generation, and it's opening at different dates throughout September and October across Canada, depending where you are. So check your local listings, your local movie listings for the times and mm-hmm. theaters. You can check everythingzoomer.com if you're listening to this on the website. It's in the post for this podcast. We'll list the dates and the cities there. And that's it. So thank you so much to Kelly, as always, for letting us use her radio booth.
Thanks, Kelly.
And thank you to Gina. Thank you to Michael Caine. And thank you to everyone for listening. And we'll see you next time on Ages and Icons.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.